Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, it's Friday, February 8th, and welcome to Newsdesk. Today, Scotland Yard under fire in Pakistan. A suicide bomber killed Benazir Bhutto, detectives say. Her family disagree. The Archbishop of Canterbury's under fire too, following his claim that the formalisation of Sharia law in Britain is unavoidable. As the criticism intensifies, we ask, can Sharia law coexist with English law? And can the Archbishop weather the storm? We'll examine the latest ideas for fighting crime, fewer police officers, and more technology. Fancy a trip to a Premier League game? Well, get yourself a plane ticket. We'll look at plans by the country's biggest clubs to play competitive league games abroad. And wouldn't you know it, you wait for a half-decent movie and then three come at once. A bumper crop at the cinema. We'll lead you down the aisle. But we start in Pakistan, an idea that seemed fine in principle. Let's bring in Scotland Yard. End the speculation surrounding the death of Benazir Bhutto, thought the president. Its detectives are the finest in the world. That should settle the argument. But it's all gone wrong. Today, Scotland Yard said that the former president was killed by a suicide bomber and found itself dragged into the controversy as her family disputed its findings. The Guardian's Declan Walsh is in Pakistan, and he gave me this update of the story.
Well, Benazir Bhutto's party and her widow, Asif Zardari, immediately rejected the Scotland Yard reports within a couple of minutes of it coming out. They say that they're convinced that Bhutto died from a bullet instead of a bomb.
And what's the significance of that? I mean, tragically, she was killed. Why does it matter?
You're absolutely right. I think from the outside, it probably looks slightly mystifying. The facts of Bhutto's death, the broad facts, are certainly not in dispute. We know that when she left that rally in Rawalpindi on December 27th, a man rushed towards her with a gun. He fired several shots, and there was a blast shortly afterwards, and then she was killed. So those things are not in dispute. What's at issue here really is an issue of credibility. On the one hand, Bhutto's family is not convinced that the Pakistani government is capable of carrying out a fair and an impartial investigation into her death. And as they see it, the cover-up over the issue of how she was killed signifies a wider problem of essentially of a government cover-up. And there's also a second element to this. The government, or the Bhutto family, in insisting that she died from a bullet, wants to keep open the possibility that there may have been a second person involved in the assassination. And the theory goes that if there was a second person who shot her, he may have been a sharpshooter, and a marksman is someone who would be more likely to come from a military background, even an army background, as opposed to a jihadi one, which is very much the story that the Pakistani government is putting out about this. So it's really an issue of credibility, but also it hints towards people's belief about who was actually behind her murder.
Because the whole point of involving Scotland Yard was to have a force that's renowned for its professionalism. What do we know about the investigation that they conducted?
Well, the problem for the Scotland Yard investigation is that it was very much within, if you like, an investigative straitjacket. Their terms of reference were very clearly to only determine the cause of Bhutto's death, not to look into the much more important question of who was behind it. The Pakistani government has maintained from the beginning that this is how she died, and they say that they brought in the Yard investigators to prove this conclusively. There's a great degree of respect for British justice and for the British system still here in Pakistan. So they were hoping to really use that cachet in order to burnish their own story, if you like. But I suspect there may be the Scotland Yard people may find that this will turn out to have been a rather thankless task for them, because immediately, as we see, it's been rejected by Bhutto's party. And people here in Pakistan are incredibly suspicious of official versions of events. You have to remember that this is a country where there have been numerous political deaths, unexplained political deaths over the years. Despite inquiries into them, none has ever been solved. And that ranges from the death of the dictator Ziaul Haq in a plane crash in 1987, to the deaths of Bhutto's own two brothers. One was shot, the other one was poisoned in the mid-1980s. So people have very strong memories of unsolved political deaths, and there's a very wide fear that this is going to be yet another of them.
That's Declan Walsh, and we'll be covering that story as it unfolds throughout the day on Guardian Unlimited. Now, when the Archbishop of Canterbury speaks, controversy inevitably follows. So today follows a familiar pattern. The extension of Sharia law is inevitable, he said. Light the blue touch paper and stand well back. The Guardian's religious affairs correspondent Riazat Butt is covering the story, and I asked her what it was about the Archbishop's comments that have caused such trouble.
What he said in his speech last night at the Royal Courts of Justice was a very long-winded, complex version of what he said to the BBC World at One yesterday. And that is that certain parts of Sharia law relating to personal matters like marriage and divorce and inheritance should be accommodated within British law. That's the nutshell of it. I think what he was referring to, and I think this is his downfall, is that he didn't explain clearly enough why there was a need to have these arrangements recognised in English law. My sister got married under Sharia law. My brother got married under Sharia law. A lot of my, well, pretty much every Muslim I know who's got married has been married under Sharia law, but some of them have chosen to have a civil ceremony, so they're protected by British law as well, which means in the future, should things not work out, they have to get a divorce through the British legal system, but they would also have to get a divorce through the Sharia system as well. It just happens all the time. We just don't make a big deal out of it. Of course, the other thing where Sharia has a really big part to play is in finance. You read about Sharia-compliant mortgages. You've now got Sharia-compliant baby bonds and investment trusts. So it is happening out there. And to be honest, the Archbishop of Canterbury has sort of reignited this very hot topic.
So is there a real sense of, drawn us to some pretty unwanted attention?
I think so. I mean, if you look at the reaction last night and if you look at the continuing criticism today, people still equate Sharia with the chopping off of hands and beheadings and floggings and whippings. That doesn't happen in this country. It does happen in Saudi. We know about that. So people are thinking about all the worst elements of Sharia law. And of course, British Muslims don't want any of that in their lives. What they want to do, and if you know anything about Sharia councils, about 90% of their cases are to do with marriage, and about 90% of the people who use Sharia councils are women. So there is a case of, who is this weirdy, beardy guy, and why is he sticking his nose into our affairs?
What's his situation now? Because obviously he seems in some ways to lurch from one crisis to the next, whether it's about homosexuality within the church or his stance on the war. When there was an intervention from him like this, does he carry the Church of England with him? And what's his level of support within the church?
I'm amazed that nobody in his circle advised him against doing that BBC interview. I honestly think if he'd stuck with delivering that dense, obtuse, very, very seriously academic speech, people might not have noticed it. He might have gotten away with it. But not only did he give the interview, his office decided to put the transcript up on the Archbishop of Canterbury's website as well. So even if you didn't hear the interview, you could see quite clearly that he was supporting certain elements of Sharia law. I think this is his first real crisis.
We are that part there. Of course, much of the furore caused by the Archbishop's remarks stem from the fact that few of us really know what Sharia law is. Mahmoud Al-Rashid speaks for the Association of Muslim Lawyers. I asked him to explain.
Sharia, the word Sharia literally means path. The Muslim jurists over the years have developed Sharia to mean Islamic law, law that gives nourishment and sustenance to society for the interaction between members of society. Now, over the years, many Muslim jurists have developed their version and their understanding of Sharia. So that's why in today's Muslim countries, over 50 of them, you'll see different implementation or understanding or interpretation of the law as it reflects the divine will of God.
Obviously, we know how the English courts work here, but how do the Sharia courts work here?
There are no formal Sharia courts. There are informal Sharia councils which advise consenting parties on, for example, domestic dispute, marital dispute or commercial dispute, matters like that. But the English law itself does not recognise the Sharia courts. There are no Sharia courts.
The Archbishop seems to be suggesting a sort of marriage of the two. How could the Sharia process be incorporated into English law?
Well, the Archbishop was suggesting a supplementary jurisdiction. for those people, not just Muslims, and it recognizes that it already exists, for example, for Jews, Orthodox Jews. They have what is called the Beth Din, where consenting parties go to the Beth Din to have certain matters resolved according to Jewish, traditional Jewish law. And that is given recognition by the English law. Likewise, what is suggesting that there may be Muslims who want to undergo the same procedure. There are certain matters they may want resolved by Muslim personal law.
But already there are some people saying the system as it is works okay. I mean, are there problems? Give us some examples of the sort of problems that can occur.
Well, personally, on a personal level, I find much of English law, what I would say, is Sharia compliant anyway, because the fundamental objective of the Sharia is to achieve justice. Now, of course, you know, we all know there are miscarriages of justice and not every law is fair, but fundamentally English law is Sharia compliant. Now, the question is there anything either within the Islamic tradition or any other tradition that can offer us an improvement on the way the family law, particularly in respect of divorce and children, is implemented here? So I don't think we should ever shut ourselves off to ideas from any part of the world.
So lastly, obviously this has been a controversial intervention by the Archbishop, but from your point of view, is it a welcome one?
It's created a debate. Unfortunately, what's happened is the way the media picked it up today, I think it misrepresents certainly what many Muslims want in this country. Many Muslims in this country, indeed all Muslims want in this country, a fair system, whether it comes from within English law, within Sharia, from Jewish law, or whatever. What we all want is a fair and just judicial system.
That was Mahmoud Al-Rashid from the Association of Muslim Lawyers, and this is New Desk from Guardian Unlimited. Time now for a look at what's in the papers, and we turn first to The Sun, where Rowan Williams dominates the front pages and the leader columns. "What a burqa," screams The Sun's front page above a picture of the Archbishop. The Telegraph says that on this most inflammatory of subjects, the Archbishop would have best kept silent. That's a view echoed in The Times, which argues that Sharia law is not compliant with human rights laws that are enshrined in the European Convention. And the FT has a scoop, a candid interview with Digby Jones, the Trade and Investment Minister, in which he contradicts the government line on plans for a crackdown on foreigners living in the UK who are non-domiciled for tax purposes. We know them as non-doms. Jones, the former CBI Director General, said the clampdown would make it much harder for him to sell Britain as a destination for skilled foreign workers and for inward investment. And the Daily Mail splashes with news that the Muslim cleric Abu Hamza is to face extradition to the United States on terrorism charges. The Egyptian-born cleric, dubbed a preacher of hate by the paper, faces spending the rest of his life in an American prison if he loses his appeal against the order. The Times reports that a squadron of paper aeroplanes will be released by a Japanese astronaut visiting the International Space Station. The traditional art of origami has reached the final frontier, the paper says. While in the Mirror, they reveal that Star Trek legend William Shatner himself, no stranger to that final frontier, has never watched the hit TV show that made his name, nor any of the spin-off movies. He's also binned all his memorabilia, or as the paper puts it, he didn't cling on to any souvenirs. Sorry about that. And for a roundup of the papers every day in your inbox, sign up at theguardian.co.uk/wrap. That's guardian.co.uk/wrap. Now, in the never-ending battle against crime, there are a few really new ideas, but here's quite a novel one. Fewer police officers. That's just one of the proposals from Sir Ronnie Flanagan, the Chief Inspector of Constabulary, whose review of policing was released yesterday. Another is an overhaul of Stop and Search. Alan Travis, our Home Affairs correspondent, gave us his take on Sir Ronnie's plans.
Well, the Home Secretary has accepted Sir Ronnie's recommendations, and we now have basically diffused politically, I think, this issue of Stop and Search, which threatened to run all the way between now and the general election. There are two different kinds, diffused using handheld new computers. New technology is the answer to many of these questions in the criminal justice field, it's thought these days. And the addition of a BlackBerry for every police officer and a new radio which links him back to the station in real time, which incidentally they believe could spell the end of the old policeman's notebook in his top pocket. In Stop and Account, the vast majority of stops on the street The same details as recorded now would simply be radioed back to the station, including the person's ethnicity, who they've been stopped, and that information would be logged and held at the station. That's going to be piloted in Birmingham for the next 3 or 4 months and then rolled out nationally later in the year. And on the more invasive stop and search, they'll continue to fill in a form, but it'll be a much shorter form. And again, the use of police BlackBerries would mean that could reduce that from about 20 minutes to 5.
Do you think that will head off all the people who've been so critical of stop and search?
Well, as the Conservatives have been most pushing strongly on this and have committed to scrap both the forms in both these forms of stop and search. So we're now down to an argument about whether it's a short form, takes 5 minutes to fill in, or it should be scrapped on the more invasive stop and search, which means the battleground is almost disappearing beneath them.
So let's talk about the numbers issue, because Sir Ronnie has a lot to say about that as well. Now, doesn't this go against the grain a bit? Because all the time we're being told that we need more police officers, more reassurance on the streets. He's suggesting that we may have fewer.
Yes, it's a blast of reality entering into political debate, which before the politicians got so obsessed with stop and search, all they could argue about policing was who could employ more police officers. And we've had a record police force in this country, 140,000 plus officers for about 3 or 4 years now. And he's saying, like every other public service, there are 3 years of famine coming up after the years of plenty. And the reality is that there are going to be fewer police officers. And politicians, he warns them not to get into what he calls an unhelpful debate, simply about numbers, but have a more useful debate about how to use those limited police resources and police officers that exist.
That's tricky though, isn't it? Because the public have been told that numbers equals safety and security.
Well, it's the mantra of the Labour government the last 10 years appear to have been, you know, more doctors, more police and more teachers. And what was once tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime, has been reduced. That slogan of more police. We have Livingston in London promising 1,000 more police officers as if that's going to solve crime in London. And here you have the government's most senior advisor on police, Ronnie Flanagan, Chief Inspector of Constabulary, saying actually it's not about more police. And indeed, he says some of those extra police they've had, chief constables haven't really known what to do with.
Wouldn't that be a hard sell with the public?
Well, I think it depends upon what those police are used for. If they see more visible presence on the street of community support officers and police officers out on patrol, unless and feel as though they're having a proper communication and relationship with them, then that quality of that relationship may improve. Now, a lot of his proposals are to try and achieve that, either through neighbourhood policing, through new levels of democratic accountability, or by opening up the kind of some of their tasks to civilianisation, like front desk duties, like taking witness statements, and other aspects of bank office procedures that the police have to go through.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
The Guardian's daily news podcast is changing. For a start, it won't be called News Desk anymore. From next Monday, February the 11th, we launch Guardian Daily, which will be available to download from first thing in the morning, Monday to Friday. So you can listen to it while you're having your breakfast or take it with you on your way to work. The best news and analysis from The Guardian's top team of reporters and commentators.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis. From guardian.co.uk.
There you see, all change. Now, following football used to be a simple thing. You supported your local team. On a Saturday, you made your way to the ground and you watched the game. Well, it's different now, of course, and there may be more change to come. The Premier League's announcement that it would like to play an international round of competitive games abroad, think Thailand, Beijing, Australia and the Middle East, has triggered uproar. In a moment, I'll be speaking to Mike Adamson from the Guardian Sport Desk. But first, a fan's eye view from Jez Walters from the Chelsea supporters site.
From our website readership, the progressive fans, the ones that are probably more forward-thinking, I think they will welcome this as long as it's done very sensitively, so that the big games, the real, you know, the ones that the fans wait for all season, the Chelsea Man United, Chelsea Spurs, the Chelsea Arsenals, they're kept at Stamford Bridge. I think there wouldn't be anyone at the Bridge who would want that. But the more progressive fans, if they're a kind of a medium weight game, for example, Portsmouth-Chelsea or even Villa-Chelsea, that was played off in a far-off country. I think there'd be many fans who would probably welcome that because our travelling support is quite good and our abroad support is excellent. We've already sold out in Athens for the following month. And, you know, if they're in far-flung places like Saudi Arabia, perhaps, or Australia or Japan, I know that many thousands of fans would be interested.
Be a money spinner, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And they're fantastic branding opportunities. I know trips abroad, if it was, you know, to Dubai or Riyadh or places that are really far-flung that otherwise perhaps you wouldn't go to see Chelsea play in a match that counted, I think would be tremendously popular.
Now, of course, as first details of this have come out, ministers are already a bit reluctant and aren't very enthusiastic about the plan. What would you say to them?
I'm surprised at that. I don't really know why they would object to it particularly. I mean, they haven't objected that strongly to foreign ownership, or they certainly haven't introduced any legislation. So I think this is probably a natural progression of the English game, and I can't see any real justifiable reason unless you've got your head in the sand. I just think, you know, I need to clarify, though, it does need to be done sensitively. And I think if any of the big games started to be put abroad, then it could cause a lot of problems, because the season tickets cost a fortune at these clubs now. I mean, we're looking at many, many, many hundreds of pounds, probably just under 1,000 for each one. You do not want the best games going abroad, and I think that would kill English football. So it just needs to be done well. But I think the Premier League are intelligent enough to realise that.
Mike Adamson from our sports team joined us. Mike, you heard what Jez Walters had to say. What did you make of that?
Well, it was quite an unusual view for a supporter, from what I've seen and heard. The majority of fans are in outrage about this. The Football Supporters Federation spokesman Malcolm Clark actually came out and said that he's hoping these plans will be scrapped. There's a couple of reasons, really. The first is the issue of sporting integrity and the fairness of playing a 39th game. It's believed that the top five teams will be seeded so that they cannot play each other. And this could have far-reaching effects on both the Championship and on relegation. Say if Manchester United are to play Derby and Arsenal are to play Tottenham, then obviously that is of great advantage to Manchester United. And if Derby is to play Manchester United and one of their rivals is to play another of its rivals, then that makes Derby's life much more difficult. The other, of course, is that they're concerned that the only thing that the owners care about now is making money, and they are not concerned at all about English supporters, the people who have grown up and made these football clubs what they are.
As you've said, a lot of fans are against it, but the Premier League are keen. It's their idea. What arguments do they put forward for why it's a good idea?
Well, they put forward the argument that if they don't do it, they will get left behind. They're following the lead of the big American leagues, the NBA, the NHL, Major League Baseball, and in particular the NFL, which has announced that it will be playing in London for the next 3 years. One game, and in Toronto, one game for the foreseeable future. And their idea is that they will end up adding an extra game to every team's schedule, and that game will be played abroad. So there'll be 16 matches abroad. And very similar to what the Premier League are doing. And the Premier League feel that if they don't do it, they will miss out on all these commercial opportunities in China and India and so on.
They're looking at the success of the NFL game at Wembley last year. But what about all the attempts there have been to give clubs more local connections, to get more local people to play? This doesn't really seem to sit very well with that.
No, it doesn't. And it's kind of it is a logical progression from the fact that half of the Premier League clubs are now owned or have the majority stakeholders are foreign. They're overseas. And the reason that these foreign businessmen have come into these clubs is to make money.
Guardian Unlimited.
In today's Football Weekly Extra, we brave the friendly fire as Don Fabio debuts at Wembley and nation takes on nation in meaningless internationals across Europe. There's plenty else besides. There's the word from Sid Lowe in Spain, Raphael Honigstein on a Super Sonntag in Deutschland, and Afrocentric excitement from our man in Ghana, Paul Doyle. All that plus the return of league football this weekend in today's Football Weekly Extra. For details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
And
And let's update you on some stories you can find elsewhere on Guardian Unlimited today. The number of properties repossessed by mortgage lenders leapt by 21% in 2007 to their highest figure since 1999, according to the Council of Mortgage Lenders. More of that on guardian.co.uk/money. John McCain has effectively secured the Republican presidential nomination as his rival Mitt Romney dropped out of the race. Only one person now stands between McCain and the US presidency. That's whoever the Democrats choose as their candidate for the November election. More on that at guardian.co.uk/America. And Simon Jenkins argues that anti-newspaper diatribes bewailing falling standards are nonsense. The glory days they hark back to were dreadfully right at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. Well, just a few days ago in America, there was Super Tuesday. Today, if you listen to the critics, is the cinematic equivalent, Super Friday, with the release of three outstanding films, one of which has already been nominated for an Oscar. Zan Brooks, the film critic of Guardian Unlimited, has had the lucky job of watching them all, and he told me what he thought.
Well, I guess it's just a very happy accident, and I guess as with Super Tuesday, there's no kind of clear runaway winner. There's three films of outstanding quality. And also there are three films that kind of provide something different for everyone. You've got a kind of meaty oil epic in There Will Be Blood, which is kind of, you know, for the challenging kind of movie. You've got the charming, touching movie in Juno, or you've got the kind of classy tearjerker with The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. So it caters to kind of all tastes.
Well, let's go through them in turn. There Will Be Blood, as you said, is about the oil industry. We've got a little clip from that. Let's hear that.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've traveled over half our state to be here tonight. I couldn't get away sooner because my new well was coming in at Coyote Hills and I had to see about it.
There Will Be Blood is the new film from Paul Thomas Anderson, who made Magnolia and Boogie Nights. And it basically all kind of centres around this real powerhouse performance from Daniel Day-Lewis as the sort of Citizen Kane of the oil industry, this man who becomes kind of corrupted as time goes on. He's being tipped as a sort of, you know, almost runaway favourite for the Best Actor Oscar later this month. And it's one of those performances that is almost over the top, but kind of self-consciously so. And it just has absolute kind of fire in its belly. And it's just compelling. I mean, it's a great movie.
The next one is Juno.
What's the prognosis, Fertile Myrtle? Minus or plus?
There it is. Little pink plus sign is so unholy.
That ain't no Etch-a-Sketch. This is one doodle that can't be undid, Holmes Gillett.
Juno is a teen pregnancy comedy, again, that centres around a really great performance, a very different kind of performance from a 20-year-old Canadian actress called Ellen Page, who's also nominated for an Oscar. It's charming, it's touching, it's light in the best possible way. Light in that it's not insubstantial, but just has a kind of a joyousness about it. And it's a really great movie. It shows that kind of, you know, a movie about a subject such as teen comedy needn't be kind of grim, but can also be kind of truthful.
Because Knocked Up was quite big last year as
Knocked
well.
Knocked Up was great. I mean, you know, I'm a bit of a sucker for these slight sort of teen movies with a bit of intelligence to them. And Juno is arguably the best we've seen in years.
Okay, the third film is The Diving Bell and The Butterfly, and that's got five stars in the paper today as well, very well thought of. This one's slightly different, and here's something from the trial. As you can hear, the trail is all music, no words there, but presumably, I don't know if there's a nod to the scriptwriters strike in the US there.
And it's probably a nod to the fact that it's actually in French, this film, so we probably wouldn't understand much of it anyway. It's also possibly a nod to the fact that the main character in this film can't speak anyway because he's suffered a stroke and he can only communicate by sort of fluttering his eyelid. Which wouldn't play well in a trailer. This is based on a true story of Jean-Dominique Bourbi, who is a journalist who suffered this stroke, and it's by the artist-turned-filmmaker Julian Schnabel. This is a real kind of classy, elegant, heart-rending film. And again, it's kind of a total antidote to either There Will Be Blood or Juno. It's something completely different.
So what's going on, taking it all together? Is there some hope here for those of us who despair of the kind of schlock that we get served
up? Yeah, it's been a really good year so far. And, you know, these are famous last words. It could all kind of crash and burn, you know, this time next week. But, you know, you've got these three films great out at the moment that are fantastic. But also still on general release, you've got, you know, the Coen Brothers' No Country for Old Men, which is superb. You've got Sweeney Todd, which I really liked. And you've got the Romanian film 4 months, 3 weeks and 2 days. So it's been a bit of a kind of annus mirabilis so far this year.
Sam Brooks, film critic of The Garden Unlimited. And that's it from us today. And as you heard earlier, it's the last hurrah from Newsdesk. As from Monday, we'll be bigger, better, stronger as The Guardian Daily, and the podcast will be available first thing in the morning. Newsdesk is dead. Long live Guardian Daily. Phil Maynard and Andy Duckworth produced this last edition. I'm Hugh Muir and I presented it. Thank you for listening to this and to all of the others, and bye for now.
Guardian Unlimited.